is copyright 1992 by National Vanguard Books. Post Office Box 330, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA. All rights reserved.
I'm William Pierce. I first contacted George Lincoln Rockwell in 1964. At the time, I was teaching physics at Oregon State University, and I was beginning to wonder what in the world was going on as the turmoil and chaos known today as the Civil Rights Revolution got underway. I didn't quite know what to make of it when my Jewish colleagues would ask me to sign petitions demanding that the university hire black faculty members and recruit black students. Then one day I saw a short television news segment of Rockwell trying to speak to a group of students at a university in California, while Jews in the audience screamed at him and threw bottles and stones. I heard only about two sentences of Rockwell's speech, and then the Jews rushed onto the stage and ripped loose the cable from his microphone. That evening, I hunted up Rockwell's address in the library and wrote him a letter. 2 years later, our correspondence had grown into full-time collaboration on my first magazine, National Socialist World. And the year after that, Rockwell was gunned down by a hate-crazed assassin. In 1964, when our relationship began, Rockwell was a 46-year-old publisher of a monthly newsletter he called The Rockwell Report, and the leader of the American Nazi Party, a small group in Arlington, Virginia. In early 1966, shortly before I moved to Virginia and began publishing National Socialist World, he reorganized his group as the National Socialist White People's Party. He had been a philosophy student at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, before the Second World War. After war broke out in Europe, he joined the Navy, became a naval aviator, and rose to the rank of commander. After the war, he studied art, and then began a small advertising agency. When he became concerned, 5 or 6 years before I did, about the growing influence of communist ideas and policies in America, he associated himself briefly with various groups and individuals having a conservative, patriotic orientation. All of these were afraid to deal openly and forthrightly with the two issues that Rockwell soon came to realize were at the core of the problem: race and the Jews. Anti-communism wasn't enough, he decided. One must attack not only the symptoms of the disease, but its cause. One must expose the Jews as bearers of the communist virus. And one also must understand that the great danger posed by the Jews is not that they generally favor leftist economic or social policies, but that they aim at destroying us through racial mixing. By 1959, he had concluded that traditional conservatism was more of an impediment than an aid to the struggle against the Jews, and he declared himself a National Socialist. Actually, he declared himself a Nazi, began wearing a uniform with a swastika armband, and greeted his followers with the Roman salute and a Heil Hitler. This touch of Hollywood in Rockwell's approach to revolutionary politics always was a bone of contention between him and me. I argued that the uniforms, flags, and theatrical behavior, even the name American Nazi Party, made it difficult for serious people to take him seriously. His medium got in the way of his message. He replied that if he put away the flags and armbands, wore a business suit, and shunned theatrics, the news media would ignore him and no one would hear what he had to say. His aim, he said, was to make people pay attention to his simple core message of the need for rebuilding a white, Jew-free America based on the principles laid down by Adolf Hitler in Mein Kampf. When he had tried to present that message in a sober, serious way, no one had paid any attention to him. The newspapers and television stations wouldn't send reporters to his press conferences. They ignored his press releases, and the public didn't even know he existed. But as soon as he raised the swastika banner, the news media went crazy and swarmed all over him. He was seen on all the TV channels, and what he said was reported in the newspapers. "Yes," I answered, "the theatrics gets attention for you, but your message gets badly distorted. The media try to make you look like a madman and a clown, and to a large extent they succeed. The result is that most of the people attracted to you are losers, social outcasts, freaks. If you want to attract winners, serious, competent, idealistic people, you need a serious image." Rockwell responded that it is the losers, the social outcasts, who make up the ranks of every revolutionary movement. They are the ones who are available, the ones who don't have anything to lose by becoming associated with a politically incorrect cause. Individually, they may not be very impressive, but large numbers of them, organized and disciplined, would make a revolutionary army. He had tried appealing to what I called the winners, to the teachers and professors, to the doctors and lawyers and engineers, to the writers and artists, to the businessmen and the craftsmen, to his fellow military officers, to the careful, responsible men and women with steady employment and stable families, and he had found that while many of them agreed with him in principle, almost none had the moral courage to stand up and be counted among the righteous. He had given speeches to groups of these people under the cover of several ostensibly conservative organizations. They would come up after his speeches, shake his hand, and tell him they admired him for saying what they also felt. But the merest suggestion from Rockwell to one of these people that he ought to participate in an effort to take America back from the Jews and their collaborators would send the fellow scurrying away in fright. They were too comfortable, too corrupted by good living and materialism, too unaccustomed to taking risks and facing opposition. Only in the masses, Rockwell finally had concluded, were the recruits to be found that he needed to launch a political campaign to take America back, and the masses could be reached only through the mass media. I still had serious doubts as to whether the type of people Rockwell was attracting with his flamboyant tactics could be disciplined and used to build an effective organization, and these doubts made me hold back from a wholehearted support of his efforts. We collaborated on the publishing of National Socialist World, and we continued to argue about other things. I gradually found out, however, that Rockwell was dead right about the moral cowardice and the servile conventionality of the great majority of Americans. Most of them would rather lose an arm and a leg than be suspected of thinking a politically incorrect thought. And as I worked and argued with Rockwell, my appreciation of his own courage and idealism grew. He was a man with several talents, any one of which could have earned a comfortable living for him. But he was also one of those rare individuals who is wholly in contact with reality, who wholly identifies with the world around him, and who therefore is incapable of ignoring what he recognizes as wrong. To Rockwell, evil must be opposed. Good must be upheld. To pretend that the world is other than it is was self-defeating. To lie about it or to try to fool others about it was unthinkable. Once his eyes were opened to the Jews and what their policies were doing to America, there was no question of keeping his mouth shut and going on about his business. He had to speak out against them. He had to fight them. He would fight them anywhere, anytime, under any conditions, no matter what the odds. and he would fight them with all the strength of his being. I'm sure that if there had been just 1,000 men like Rockwell in America in 1966, we'd be living in a healthy, progressive, all-white America today. Like all of us, Rockwell had shortcomings, of course. He was sometimes mistaken in his facts. He thought Pablo Picasso was a Jew, for example. He sometimes misjudged character in people. He had a tendency to oversimplify things. And I'm convinced more than ever that both his theatrical tactics and his strategy of trying to persuade the masses before recruiting an elite cadre and building a strong infrastructure were unsound. His evaluations of the basic moral health of America and of the intelligence and character of the American people were far too optimistic. He really believed in 1966 that the Jews and their collaborators could be beaten by 1972. His optimism fueled his activity, and he eagerly sought opportunities to carry his message to anyone who would listen. He spoke at many schools during the last 2 years of his life, and we are fortunate to have a complete recording of a speech he gave at Brown University in the spring of 1966. The speech you will hear now will give you at least a sample of George Lincoln Rockwell's message, and at the same time, it should give you some idea of the flavor and style of the man.
Thank you very much, Helmkamp. And let me start off this speech by saying that I am very, very grateful and deeply moved to be addressing my own university after 5 years of speaking at colleges all over the country. I am very grateful for the opportunity afforded me by the academic community. It is the last, as far as I'm concerned, it is the last vestige of free speech left in our country. Sorry to say, it's usually accorded to me by liberals. Conservatives are usually too chicken to let me speak. And I want to again say how grateful I am, regardless of the politics of the Open Mind Club. I am most grateful to them for the fight they have put up to see that there is not only free speech for communists, but also free speech for anti-communists. I would like to also say that I am not here to abuse that privilege. I am not going to insult anybody or use any racial epithets and that sort of thing. When I operate in the streets, I am not ashamed to say that I agitate. My opponents, they certainly agitate. They use every possible method of agitation. And in the street, that's often the only way that you can gain public attention. And I do it all the time and go to jail for it. I am not here to agitate. You see no uniforms. There is no party buttons. There will be no attempt in any way to agitate. I am here to present to the best of my ability facts and ideas which changed me from an ordinary student at Brown University, as many of you are, to the point where I am now proud to stand before you as a National Socialist. And I'm going to try to give you some insight tonight into the facts which came to my attention, which I believe you've been denied, which caused me to make that change. All I can do, ladies and gentlemen, is to present to you a very few samples of what I consider to be shocking facts and ask you to do what I had to do after I found out these things and go check them out for yourselves. Now, I understand, unlike any other speech that I've made around the country, and I make them every day, all over America and around Canada, I have a paragraph here from this morning's paper. It says, an ad hoc committee formed to educate the student body and public at large about Rockwell's group has been working all week to nullify in advance the effect of anything Rockwell has to say. Well, now, ladies and gentlemen, there is a concept known as prejudging things, when you judge something in advance before you've heard it or seen it, and it's called prejudice. And anybody who has walked into this hall and prejudged my speech on the basis of this week's work of my opponents who haven't got the guts to face me, they will never debate me. I have asked and asked and asked if they will, in a formal manner, stand up and debate me. And I hereby again say, if in an orderly manner at any time I will be reinvited here, I will debate the head of the ADL, I will debate the B'nai B'rith, the Hillel Foundation, or anybody else who wants to stand up and challenge the facts that I'll present, but they'll never do it. They talk behind my back what a rat I am and show you movies and so forth, propaganda. They will not debate the facts. This is an unusual circumstance. It's always done at most colleges. I've never seen anybody spend a whole week trying to ruin what I can do in 50 minutes. And I think I'm going to cream them anyway. Now, let me start off my regular presentation by saying this to you, ladies and gentlemen. To the best of my knowledge, you've had at least three communists speak here at Brown University and at Pembroke. In fact, one of them, I think Mr. Jackson, had tea with the girls here at Pembroke. I wonder... He did. I think it was 2 years ago. He not only spoke, but they had a tea for him. I wonder how many of the Jews who have been raising the devil about me speaking here raised any fuss at all about the communists not only speaking, but having tea with our Pembroke girls. I have never heard of any Jew fussing about any communist coming to speak. The only time they fuss is when an anti-communist comes to speak. Now, I'll present that for your own judgment. You look back and see if you remember any fuss, any $700 worth of policemen necessary to protect any communist speaker. I haven't heard of it. Now, the reason for it, ladies and gentlemen, is because the Jews do not want certain facts to come to your attention. I maintain you are not only the victims of what they call managed news, you're the victims of suppressed news. News that you're not allowed to hear. I didn't hear it when I was sitting out there where you are. In fact, the last time I was at Alumni Hall, though, come to think, but I wasn't sitting. I was hanging on to a girl about half stewed at a dance. But in the times when I used to be sitting out there as a member of the Brown audience, they told me about Adolf Hitler and that he was out to conquer my country. I didn't just think about it or talk about it. I did something about it. I enlisted as a sailor in the United States Navy to go fight him because I believed all that I had been told. And I have since found out, ladies and gentlemen, that I was told a lot of lies, and I'm going to present some of them here to you tonight. Now, what I maintain, ladies and gentlemen, the whole thrust of my speech tonight will be that you cannot have an educated opinion. You cannot manage the affairs of a so-called democracy unless you are given all the facts. If you are denied some of the facts, or if the facts are twisted or misrepresented, then you cannot possibly guide the ship of state, any more than a navigator could guide a ship if you deprived him of the information of his latitude and longitude, the speed of the ship, and so forth. You have got to let people know the facts of the matter before they can judge correctly. And I maintain that most people who are liberals, and I have found that they are sincere, dedicated and sincere people are liberals, and most of them in the academic community are liberals. The reason is because the facts that they are given leave them no choice. Now, the reason for it, ladies and gentlemen, I maintain, as I've said, is that you are deprived of facts. Your minds work in many ways like a computer. You are not exactly like a computer, but your minds work like a computer in this respect. If you feed into a computer false information, you know you are not going to get good information, good solutions out. If you feed lies into a computer, you're going to get lies and false information out. If you neglect to put information into a computer, you can't get valid answers. Your minds work the same way. If they have some way of keeping from you knowledge which you must know, you cannot make valid decisions. Now, I have said I cannot present all the facts that changed me to the point where I'm leading a Nazi movement around the world. I can present a few of the most shocking, and it is my hope, and it's been my experience throughout the country as I've spoken, in spite of all the prejudging, in spite of all the education, as they call it, before I speak, when I show you some of these facts, I think you will have the same experience that other students have had at other colleges. Some of you will have the guts and the integrity to go at least and check and find out whether these things exist, whether they're what I say they are, and if they are, you will begin to change your judgments. Now, before I present my first document, let me say this. I invariably run into the business. They say, oh, well, Rockwell's just waving a piece of paper up there. How do we know what it says on it? Or he's taking it out of context. Well, first, let me say this to you. Every document that I'm going to present to you, you can get from me for nothing, free. All the address you need is George Lincoln Rockwell, Arlington, Virginia. And I will send you the full document, not the part that I'm going to read, because I can't read all the documents, all of the whole of them. I will read portions of them, and you can send for and get the entire document. Before I made this speech, I was required to submit the documents to the committee. They've seen them all. And I assure you they're on the level. I'll go further. If anybody, Jewish war veteran, or anybody else here, can prove that I am lying about any of these documents, that they don't exist, they're phony documents, I will go to work for Harry Golden and Martin Luther King for nothing in the NAACP. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the first document I want to show you is by a man of unimpeachable credentials, a man that I'm sure you cannot say is a bigot or a hate monger or there's anything wrong with him. a man that you cannot find fault with. And I think what he says you will find extremely shocking. This document right here, it's reduced, it's a full-page newspaper article. The author of it is Winston Churchill. His picture is on it. I wonder if there's a people booing and hissing for Winston Churchill. That's a new one on me. Winston Churchill is the author of this article. I will give you the date. I got it out of the Library of Congress, February 8, 1920, illustrated London Sunday Herald. The Library of Congress made the copy from which I reproduced this copy here. It's called Zionism versus Bolshevism, a struggle for the soul of the Jewish people. And Winston Churchill in this article says the Jews are being torn. Half of them want to be Zionists and half of them want to be communists. And he suggests they should all be Zionists. But he does say something that I want you to listen to. He discusses the Russian Revolution. Now let me read you a paragraph in which Winston Churchill is discussing. First he discusses the Zionists, now he's going to take up the communists and the Jews, and here's what he says. International Jews, in violent opposition to all the sphere of Jewish effort, rise the schemes of the international Jews. The adherents of this sinister confederacy are mostly men reared up among the unhappy populations of countries where the Jews are persecuted on account of their race. Most, if not all of them, have forsaken the faith of their forefathers and divorced from their minds all spiritual hopes of the next world. This movement, talk about communism, this movement among the Jews is not new. From the days of Spartacus Weishaupt to those of Karl Marx, and needless to parenthetically, Karl Marx, of course, was Jewish, to those of Karl Marx and down to Trotsky, and I think very few of you know that Trotsky's real name was Bronstein, Leon Bronstein, not Trotsky. To Trotsky in Russia, Bella Kuhn in Hungary, Rosa Luxemburg in Germany, and Emma Goldman in the United States, this worldwide conspiracy for the overthrow of civilization and for the reconstitution of society on the basis of arrested development, of envious malevolence, and impossible equality has been steadily growing. It played, as a modern writer, Mrs. Webster, has so ably shown, a definitely recognizable part in the tragedy of the French Revolution. It has been the mainspring of every subversive movement in the 19th century. Now, listen to this, ladies and gentlemen. This is Winston Churchill telling you about the Russian Revolution. And now, at last, this band of extraordinary personalities from the underworld of the great cities of Europe and America have gripped the Russian people by the hair of their heads and have become practically the undisputed masters of this enormous empire. Now, you Jewish war veterans, you just proved that Churchill didn't say that. Or you just proved that I misread it, or you just disproved that the Russian Revolution wasn't Russian, or rather that it wasn't Jewish, that it was Russian, and I'll quit. What I'm telling you, ladies and gentlemen, is that you have not been told in your history classes that the Russian Revolution wasn't Russian. It was the capture of Russia by the Jews. That's the truth. Now, you can call me any name you want. If Winston Churchill said this, and if it's true, then you must ask yourself, how come you haven't been told this? Why are you not allowed to know this? Now, yelling and hollering, I go through this all the time. Nobody's going to shut me up by yelling, or it would have been done long ago. I'm just telling you that this is just one of the facts that I began to look into. Then I began to discover there were more. You have the bag there. I want to show you some documents I got from the United States Archives, from the United States of America Archives in Washington, D.C., sealed with the seal of the United States. They're sealed with ribbons here. Here's one of them. These are reports. Now, again, if there's anything fake about these documents, you just stop me. Put me out of business. This is a public statement. If this is phony, you just prove it, and I'll fold up and quit and go to work. In fact, I'll work for the Jewish war veterans. I'll put on a Star of David if this is phony. Here we have a report. Remember, I will send you a printed copy of this, if you wish, so you can check to see whether this is on the level. It's gotten from the United States government. It would be forgery to fake it. And here is a report from the intelligence section of the United States Army to the United States Army and the President of the United States during the Russian Revolution about the nature of the Russian government. He says, a table made up in April 1918, the correspondent of the London Times shows that at that time there were 384 commissars in the top government of Russia, including two Negroes, 13 Russians, 15 Chinamen, 22 Armenians, and more than 300 Jews. This is the government of Russia. Now, here comes another report in the same dossier here. He says, it is probably unwise to say this loudly in the United States, but the Bolshevik movement is and has been made up since its beginning and guided and controlled by Russian Jews of the greasiest type. That's the fact, ladies and gentlemen. Now, these documents, when I first saw these things myself, I couldn't believe them. I thought, well, how could I possibly not have heard this from all my history professors, from Professor Ducasse in the philosophy department where I was a major? How come I didn't know about this when I first found it? Somebody is pulling my leg. So I started studying the Jewish documents. I went to the San Diego Library and got the Universal Jewish Encyclopedia. You must have it over here in the library. Go get it and look up the Russian Revolution, and you will find these Jews boasting how they put on the Russian Revolution. But whoever reads it, they don't assign that in the history course. This is for their boys to read so they can tell each other how good they're doing. You're not supposed to know about it. And I maintain that unless you do know it, unless you do know where communism is coming from and you're willing to talk about it, you will never be able to deal with it, whether you like it or not. I mean, whether you like communism or you don't like it, you ought at least to know that the Jewish people are behind it. And once you understand that, then you can deal realistically with it, whether you like it or not, one way or the other. Until you do know it and until you can talk about it, you are deprived of information. Now, let me point something out, ladies and gentlemen. In Russia, you have freedom of speech. You can criticize anybody you want except the communists. In China, you have freedom of speech. You can criticize anybody you want except the communists. In Cuba, you can criticize anybody you want except Castro. In the United States of America, you can criticize Irishmen, Italians, Frenchmen, people from Brown, Pembrokers, but you can't criticize Jews. And if you think you can, try it. Just go out and you say, you know, I think Rockwell is right. I think these Jews are pulling something rotten on us. Try it. You'll be called an anti-Semite. You'll be subjected to terrorism. What the kids that have invited... Well, let me... You don't believe it, eh? I have spoken all over the country now for years, no difficulties at all. This is the first time when I have ever spoken where I've been treated so dishonorably, and the pressure comes from the Jewish war veterans, all these Jewish groups, who never complain about the communists. I had to come up here at my expense, no fee, and I had to pay to come here to talk at Brown University because, first of all, my invitations were canceled by the college. And then when a brave bunch of kids invited me again, they were subjected to every kind of pressure in the world. A good example is right here where you're sitting. I told them every time I speak at a college, I draw the biggest crowds of any speaker they've ever had except possibly the president or somebody like that. Get a big hall. So what do they give them? Alumni hall. And they only let you have a few. And then they charge them $700 for police protection. And then you tell me that there is not some pressure? Why hasn't this happened to the communists? If these Jews are not committing pressure in order to avoid you, keep you from hearing this, how come this all happens right here, right now, tonight, in front of your eyes? What's going on? I maintain that there's nobody has the right to tell you what you can hear and what you can't hear. Now I want to show you why you are not allowed to know these facts and how the Jews go about it. They don't burn books. They're much more clever than to burn them. They have a much better technique, and we have a letter here that they sent out, which will show you what their technique is, which is a lot viler than burning books. This is from the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith to publishers all over America. Again, send for this document. Anybody who wants to challenge me, just send for it. I'll give you a printed copy of our original photostat. You send for it, and you read it for yourself. I'm going to read you some excerpts and show you how these Jews operate so you can't find out what's going on. Listen to this. Scribner's and Sons have just published a book by Madison Grant entitled The Conquest of a Continent. It is extremely antagonistic to Jewish interests, emphasized throughout as the Nordic superiority theory and the utter negation of any melting pot philosophy with regard to America. The book, by the way, at no time criticizes Jews. It simply says the white man is a master race and created America. The Jews don't want you to read about that or hear that. Now listen to what they do about it. Now think this is only, I'm going to read about six words in the next sentence, or seven words. You think what these words mean and what they've done. Here's the beginning of the third paragraph. We are interested in stifling the sale of this book. And they have. You can't get it. You can't buy it. They don't burn it because then you'd know about it. They just quietly use their business genius. And I'm not about to deny that they're business geniuses. They can rise to the top of almost any business. They get control, and they simply say to booksellers, if you sell any book that we don't like, you won't get any more books. So you can't buy books that they don't like. And I maintain that's wrong. Now, I told you, I've written a book. Maybe it's the worst book in the world, but don't you think you should be able to decide that for yourself? Do you think the Jewish war veterans and the Anti-Defamation League should be able to get together and say, you will not read Rockwell's book, you won't hear him speak? If he does speak, he'll speak in a small hall. We'll cut off his money. We'll do everything to shut him up. I don't think you're so stupid that you can't judge, and you have to have a bunch of Jewish war veterans tell you what you're going to like and what you're not going to like. This is what the whole thrust of my speech is that you are being not only denied information, but you are being told what you will like and what you will not like. And in case you rebel, in case you say, oh, no, I won't go along with that, they use plain old-fashioned terrorism. Or anybody thinks that they don't, try doing like I do. Do it yourself. Get up and give a so-called anti-Semitic speech. Start talking about Churchill's paper out here on campus. And if you're not, unless you're very well organized and you got troops, you'll find yourself with a bloody nose. I'm telling you the truth. You just simply have got to fight. These Jewish war veterans will attack you. They have attacked me physically. I'm not afraid of them. I'd be glad to walk out any place where they are, but they don't argue with you. They won't deny what you say. They just say, we're going to shut you up. Now, I don't think that's American. These people claim they're American. They don't want to shut up communists. They want to shut up anti-communists. And if that doesn't tell what they're doing, then I don't know what I have to show for proof. I'd like to show one more document here. This one's a hard one to get. This is about me, put out by the American Jewish Committee. It's secret. It's not for publication. And they send it all around to the editors and publishers of America. Again, if you don't believe me, you're welcome to get a copy of this charming Jewish document. It's called Bigot Seeking Buildup, The News Techniques of George Lincoln Rockwell. And it's 8 long pages, my fellow Brown and Pembroke students here, 8 long pages on how to be sure that you never hear a word that I have to say. It says never argue with Rockwell, never refute his facts, just point out what a rat he is. That's the substance of this whole book. Just keep calling him a rat, a louse, sick, anything you can. Call him names, argumentum ad hominem. Never argue his facts because they can't. They have no facts to argue. They just simply abuse me and attack me physically, which is not argument. They have no facts to go on. Everywhere, you can holler all you want. Everywhere, people are getting fed up with what's called minority pressure. People are fed up with it. This is supposed to be a majority government, not a government by a bunch of minorities who say, if you don't go the way we do, we're going to urinate the streets. We're going to have demonstrations over here. This government is supposed to go the way the majority wants it to go. But it ain't. This government goes the way the minority, that's the loudest and the brassiest, says it must go. And you know who that loud and brassy minority is. They get their way, and they've got to the point where how many of you people have the nerve anymore to come out? You'll say an Italian, or a Frenchman, or an Irishman. How many have the nerve to just say the word Jew? When I was in college right here, we used to say, a nice Jewish boy. You never just say a Jew. You're scared. You don't maybe realize it down deeply, but they've got us scared to death. And that's one of the reasons. Well, any of you who think that you haven't, just try criticizing them. Just try when you leave here, just as an experiment, whether you believe it or not, pick out the nearest Jew and say, you know, I think Rockwell is right. I think he's got something there. You see what happens to you. If you're a professor here, get you up in your classroom tomorrow and say, I think Rockwell is right, and see how long you're teaching at Brown University. Which ought to show you something. This is supposed to be a free college. There's a lot of colleges in the country where people say, I'm a communist. Let's send blood to the Viet Cong. And if they try to fire them, the students go out and kidnap the dean and tear up the school and so forth. Why couldn't a professor here be a Nazi? Well, you just try it. This has resulted, ladies and gentlemen, this climate of terrorism against an idea. Any idea against the fact that there is not equality among the races or any information about the Jews is banned. If you mention anything about the races not being equal or that the Jews might be mixed up in communism or behind race mixing, if you talk about any of those things, you are silenced and shut up. And I don't think that's right. Maybe I'm wrong. I fully recognize that I could be wrong. But the way to show me that I'm wrong and get me to quit isn't to beat me over the head. Nobody will ever get me to quit by beating on me. And nobody will ever get me quit by hollering rat like this man did. No matter what you call me, as long as I think I'm right in my heart, I'm going to preach it. But not one of these people that yell, not one of them, has ever got the guts to stand up in public and debate me and say, no, your facts are wrong, Mr. Rockwell. Here is the truth. Never in 6 years of speaking at colleges will one of these people do it. They say they will. I've had them come up on the stage and shake my hand. They're going to debate next week. And when the next week comes, they're gone. They're on a vacation. You can't find them. These people have no argument to stand by. They have no facts. I do. And I'm going to believe them. As long as I have the documents, bag fulls, box fulls, library fulls of them, I'm going to believe the facts and not somebody screaming at me or trying to punch me in the nose. This has resulted, ladies and gentlemen, this deprivation that you are suffering of the lack of news, the lack of the facts, has resulted in what they call liberalism. I don't blame you a bit. Given the fact that you're told that the only difference between Negroes and white people is that that the Negro is a white man with a dark skin. If that's the truth, then we have no business discriminating one bit. We should marry them, we should mix with them, there should be absolutely no discrimination. If there is a difference other than the color of skin, then we ought to discuss it. But that you can't do. The minute you try to point out the fact that there are differences, psychological differences, other than color of the skin, then you're in trouble. You're a racist, you're a Nazi, you're a fascist, you're a hater, a bigot. All of these are names. Nobody discusses the facts. There's plenty of facts to prove exactly what the Negroes are. I'm not going to go into them tonight. I'd be glad to debate that subject, too, formally at any time anybody wants to set one up. Nobody will. They simply use name-calling. The result is that this liberalism has spread throughout our country, and as I've said, I don't blame those who believe it because the facts give you no choice. If the facts are as they say they are, the Jews are wonderful, Negroes are even better, then we ought to mix. Jews ought to run the country, and we might as well fold up us. White Christians, we got no business trying to run our country. We're too stupid. But that isn't a fact. And what's happened, ladies and gentlemen, the Roman Empire perished from senility, from old age. It decayed. It went rotten. America is not an old country, but it is decaying. It's getting rotten. And right with me here in Providence, I have one of the communist Viet Cong flags that I tore down with my own hands and went to jail for doing it. The communist traitor that was parading around in front of our White House went on parading and I went to jail. Treason is going on right in our country, right in front of us, and nobody even gets indignant. Nobody cares anymore. But that's the least of it. This prevailing... Remember what Khrushchev said? They asked him how come he thought that he was going to take over the United States by 1972. He says, you're all too liberal to fight. Americans have become too liberal to fight. And it's true. Americans just sit around and watch anything happen. Absolutely anything goes. And nobody will do anything about it. And this is why I so much admire the Open Mind Committee. They just told me here that they got a little bit put out when they saw all these communists speaking and I couldn't speak. They didn't agree with me, but they thought they'd form a committee to give me my right to speak. And that's the kind of thing that I did. That's why I'm a Nazi, because I got sick and tired of seeing people pushed and nobody doing anything about it. Everybody whispering, well, you know what the Jews did now? I was a conservative for years, and everybody would whisper about the Eskimos, and you know those and so forth. Well, I think that's hypocrisy and cowardice. If you're a conservative and you know what the Jews are doing, you ought to tell people and discuss it in the open and not sneak around behind anybody's back about it. So I did something about it, and I'm trying to form a movement to create the vigor and the strength to stop the decay and the rot that is happening in America. Now, the reason that America is decaying and is getting rotten isn't because we're old. It isn't because we're senile and feeble. It is because we are being purposefully rotted. The soul of America is being rotted out by germs. It is being, at every point that you want to look, you will find it being consciously and purposefully turned rotten. Let me take a few examples. Let's take art and culture. I majored in philosophy, and I won first prize in the United States in 1948 for commercial art, for a full-page ad in the New York Times for the American Cancer Society. So I know something what I'm talking about in art. And when I was studying art, they tried to make me draw this crazy stuff, screwball paintings and so forth, and I just couldn't see it. It looked crazy to me. And it looked crazy to the other people, but they wouldn't admit it. I just said, it is screwy. So I wouldn't do it. I did good art and won first prize. But I began to wonder, years later, when I got into this movement, where did this come from? Where did this screwy art begin? Who is the patron saint of this screwy stuff that looks like an automobile accident? It looks like an automobile accident in paint. Well, the guy that did it, the patron saint, is Picasso. And at first I thought he was a Spaniard. Well, I found out he was a communist. Of course, that's not too new to anybody. He did the peace stub for Moscow, and he's a red, so I thought it was communist art. Then I found out the real secret. He's one of the boys. And the next thing I began to examine was this screwy poetry. About 7 years ago, two guys in Australia took the Australian Army Manual for the Control of Mosquitoes. And they took every seventh or eighth word and they put them on the page, sprinkled it all around like blank verse, and they won first prize in the international poetry contest. So I began to examine who is the patron saint. Where did this come from? Well, it turned out it was a queer Jewish named Gertrude Stein. Remember, a rose is a rose is a rose, and her whole cult over there in Paris. Then there'd be sculpture. So they took me down to study sculpture at the Museum of Modern Art, and you go into the Museum of Modern Art, and here is this big podium, and they have piled, looks like somebody went out into a pasture and scooped up three or four and piled them up like this. And this is sculpture. Well, who is the guy that's... Jacob Epstein is the patron saint of this thing. Well, I could go on and on. Any fields you want to go, wherever you dig, you find the rot. Who is the guy that's going to the federal penitentiary for the rottenest, filthy magazine that's ever been printed? Ginsberg. Ralph Ginsberg. Who is the poet, the great beatnik poet that has the foulest, dirtiest poetry ever heard? Ralph Ginsberg. Not Ralph Ginsberg. What's his name? You know, the bearded crud there, the bum. But to me, ladies and gentlemen, it's bad enough that they're doing this to our culture. What they're doing is destroying all order in art. I know something about art, like I told you, and it's based on order and discipline. In fact, what they used to teach in colleges was called a discipline, the discipline of this and the discipline of that. Now, any discipline at all is considered some kind of treason. The students say, we want to run the college out at Berkeley. And if they don't, as I say, they kidnap the dean, kidnap the cops, push everybody around, and the Negroes want to run the country. And if they don't, then they urinate all over the streets of Birmingham. And what they're doing, ladies and gentlemen, they are purposefully destroying order. You hear about law and order, the key thing is order. Without order, there is no society. And in order to have order, you've got to have law. Now, I just had a rally out in San Francisco about 3 weeks ago. I had a permit. I had every right to be there. And the police told me when I went to go down there that there were 3,000 longshoremen coming down to bust me up. So I said, well, I only got 26 guys. Maybe you ought to have some policemen there. He says, no. He says, that'll provoke them. We won't have any police. There anyway, with my 26 guys, and sure enough, there were no policemen, and sure enough, the longshoremen and the beatniks and the cruds and the bearded bums and all kind of queers, everything they had in San Francisco descended on us. Every skid in 1,000 miles was there, screaming and hollering, you're a bum, Rockwell, you're sick, listen, Rockwell, you're sick, and so forth, screaming, and they started throwing stuff and everything else. Finally, after a half an hour or so of this, two traffic cops showed up and tried to pinch me for parking. So the cops almost got killed, trying to push. They said, now, fellas, please, please move back. You shouldn't do this. Now, you shouldn't be throwing those things at Rockwell. How about moving back? And bam, they socked the cops. So the cops radioed for help. More cops came, a few more cops, and a few more. Still no helmets, still no clubs. By this time, the mob was a real riot. Everything going on all over. Then they had to bring in all the cops they could get. Riot helmets and sticks, beeline in every direction. What a fight that was. Now, do you know what happened during this beating going on? Five guys attacked the police. Five guys were arrested and put in the police patrol for attacking police officers. So the crowd attacked the police van. They forgot me for a while. They attacked the police van, and do you know what the cops did? Guess what? They let them out because it might provoke them to take them off to jail. So they let the five guys out. Now, do you know what that means, ladies and gentlemen? Only one thing. It means that there is no law in San Francisco. If you've got a big enough mob, you tell the police what to do, not the other way around. Those cops should have used every gun they had in the whole army to keep those prisoners they had to. Once you allow law to break down, there is no end. You have no law unless it's enforced. And in San Francisco, I with my own eyes saw a mob take over San Francisco and run the cops out and do what they had a mind to, and the cops just ran away. They couldn't do anything else. It's not the cops' fault, because politicians control police officers. And the first thing, well, here's somebody having a big ball. He enjoys hearing about the cops having a tough time. The first thing that happens, ladies and gentlemen, when you destroy law and order is that you become defenseless. And this is what's happened in cities all over this country. Do you know that the girls in this auditorium could not, I don't know how it is in Providence here, in my day you were safe, but in Washington, D.C., Right across from where I live, you could not walk along the streets of Washington, D.C. day or night. You'll be picked up by the cops and told that you better get somebody to be with you because you'll be raped. You can't walk on the streets because they're dropping out of trees. They're coming out of alleys. Now, I'm not exaggerating, ladies and gentlemen. I'm telling you, this is they actually did drop out of a tree onto the daughter of one of the big State Department officials. Of course, some of the time when you drop on a State Department official, you might get surprised. You don't know which sex you're dropping on. And while I'm on that subject, there's another example of what we've come to. This country has come to the point, when I was a kid, you hardly ever heard of queers. Once in a while, you'd hear something about there was such a thing as queers, but I don't remember seeing one or knowing much about them. Now they have a lobby to get rid of us, the Mattachine Society. They say we're dirty-minded. They have dances. They had a convention, and they got the biggest hotel, I think it was the Sheraton Park on the Shore, the biggest and best hotel in Washington they got for the queers convention. Now, it may sound funny, but my point is this, ladies and gentlemen. Our country has reached the point where we will tolerate anything. There is literally no limit to what will be tolerated. And the time has got to come where you draw the line at something, when you say, this is immoral and wrong and we're going to put a stop to it. Nobody will do it so long as law and order is gone. And this is what I maintain has happened in this country. Law and order is being consciously destroyed. You know this holler you hear, police...